This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, welcome back. Crossover NBA podcast. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. Beck is back. A short stint on the injured list, but he is back on the show. What's happening, Beck?
Doing all right. Shoulder, not great. Mouth, still works. So we can pod.
We can pod, and you can figure out the process of one-handed writing for a couple of weeks anyway. All right, lot to get into, Beck. Good episode last week. You talked to some people that were part of the Space Jam 2 universe, which is out right now in theaters and on HBO Max. You get the week off, though, this week, as my conversation with Jerry Colangelo, the outgoing managing director of USA Basketball, will be up on Friday. We spent about 45 minutes out in Las Vegas, Beck, talking about Jerry's past with USA Basketball, really the future of USA Basketball, which we're going to get into here on this show, because right now, not looking great for Team USA. So
I can't wait to hear your conversation with Jerry. He's never one to. I mean, he's like inherently political, I think, in a lot of ways, in his position, and has long been in the NBA, whether as Suns owner or with USA Basketball. But he's the kind of person who doesn't mince words as well. Like, he can be very political, but at the same time, he can be pretty blunt. So I can't wait to hear what you got from him. And then I'd be interested to hear him again once this Olympics is over, because things are not exactly trending in the right direction. But I'm sure there are hints of that in your talk.
Yeah, I learned a lot from the conversation. Jerry is an excellent storyteller, and he has got decades worth of basketball life experience to draw on. So it was a really fun conversation, and we get into a lot of the meaty topics I think people will want to hear about. So that'll come out on Friday here on the Crossover feed. Let's start this show, Howard, with the breaking news. Just Monday afternoon, we had the first significant trade of NBA draft week. Memphis, they are finalizing a deal, this according to ESPN, to send Jonas Valanciunas and the number 17 and 51 picks in this draft to New Orleans for Steven Adams, Eric Bledsoe, the number 10 and 40 picks in this draft, and a protected 2022 first-round pick, which belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. Pretty significant, and a lot of ways to kind of dive into this. I'll give you my take on it first, Howard. My big 10,000-foot takeaway is that the Pelicans seem like they're gearing up to take a big swing in free agency. What this deal does is get them out from under the contracts of Eric Bledsoe, the contract of Steven Adams, and gives them some flexibility. They could conceivably have as much as $36 million in available cap space, could be a little bit lower if they go after and retain Josh Hart, right around $25 million. But it does seem like the Pelicans are looking to add a veteran piece to this young core. We know they have Zion Williamson. We know they have Brandon Ingram. They were in the mix last year for the play-in tournament. Didn't quite get there, but it sure seems like the front office in New Orleans wants to make sure they're in the playoff picture this year and wants to make sure they have enough veteran pieces to make that work. Give me your reaction to this trade that broke on Monday.
Well, the first thought is just that, you know, here we are less than a year after they made this big swing to get Steven Adams and gave him an extension and everything else, and they're already shipping him out. So there's kind of an admission of a misfire on Steven Adams, just as they had to part ways with Stan Van Gundy after less than a year. So it's been bumpy for this front office. We got to put that out there right up front. And the pressure's on, because you got Zion Williamson. You can't afford to waste any time. And, you know, look, his first 2 years, you know, 1 year's marred by injury his rookie season. You make a coaching change his second year. It's still a pandemic year. A lot of weird stuff goes on. You traded Drew Holiday. So, like, there are circumstances, but that doesn't matter if you're Zion or Zion's family and his advisors. We know young stars in this league can get impatient really quickly. And so you've got to do everything possible. So I like the boldness of this move to make a move for Jonas Valanciunas, who is a much better fit alongside Zion. Valanciunas can stretch the defense a bit. And so I think that part makes sense. Bledsoe was never that great of a producer for them there. They've got a lot of questions in that backcourt now with Lonzo Ball obviously entering restricted free agency. So where does that go? But that may lead back around to the point that you made, Chris, which is they're clearing cap room. And our buddy Mark Stein has reported recently about their interest in Kyle Lowry. Now, a lot of teams are interested in Kyle Lowry. Lowry, despite his age and mileage, remains a really effective and very much desired player in free agency. And so Miami, Dallas, the LA teams, not that they have the cap room, Philly and New Orleans, all of them in the chase, maybe others as well. But they need an upgrade at point guard. You know, we've seen time and again in this league, and the Phoenix Suns just gave us a vivid example again. You can have a lot of good young talent, but you need somebody to pull it all together. And once the Pelicans traded Drew Holiday, who could have been that guy, was partially that guy, you know, they didn't really have it. So Lowry would be phenomenal for them. And I think that's certainly the kind of thing that pushes them forward, gets them into the playoff mix, and makes Zion Williamson feel better about their direction. But even on its face, just getting Valanciunas instead of Steven Adams, I think, is an upgrade. And you can see that by they paid a steep price. They basically, this is the other way to look at it. The Pelicans basically backed down from the 10th pick to 17th. So traded back 7 spots in the first round, but traded up 11 spots in the second round. That's the way that ends up working. But it's really that extra first-round pick, the Laker pick that they own in 2022, going to Memphis, that shows you how incentivized motivated the Pelicans were to get Valanciunas, because they gave up the higher pick this year and an extra first-round pick next season. Is that too much to swap Adams for Valanciunas? I don't know. Valanciunas was pretty damn good for the Grizzlies. And again, the Pelicans need to move quickly to get this thing on the right path.
I'm not so sure that Valanciunas is a significant upgrade over Steven Adams. I mean, he theoretically spaces the floor a little bit better, shot almost 37% from three, but attempted less than 1 per game. So it's not like he's this prolific three-point shooter at the center position. I think
His mid-range game, though, it's, like he's got a face-up game that Adams doesn't have.
I don't disagree. I just would go back to, it sure seems to me like this deal was done for cap flexibility to go out and be a player on that point guard market. It's one of the more robust point guard markets that we've seen in a while. I mean, out west, you've got Mike Conley on the free agent market. You've got potentially Chris Paul on the free agent market, which we're not putting Chris Paul in the conversation with New Orleans, but he's there. You know, you've mentioned the guys in the Eastern Conference headlined by Kyle Lowry. So there's a chance with cap flexibility for New Orleans to make a big splash. And I think that's their goal here. What troubles me a little bit, maybe trouble's too strong a word, but I get kind of hung up on a little bit. You know, I hear about this clock ticking with Zion, right? Like, it's sort of ticking, but it's ticking very, very softly, because Zion still has, 2 years left on his rookie deal. And after that, no player in the history of rookie contracts has ever turned down a max level extension. So let's say he signs a 5-year deal with a 4-year opt out. You're talking about having control over Zion Williamson for 6 years, at least at this point. It's a lot of time. And I wouldn't, I would encourage the Pelicans to do everything they can to get better. I don't know that I want to be mortgaging the future or surrendering the long term, if that's a softer way of putting it, just to get like the 7th seed right now, or to lock myself into the 7th seed right now. I'd want to kind of play this out and develop as many young guys. Now, it's pretty clear New Orleans doesn't believe in Lonzo Ball. Other teams do. Chicago loves Lonzo Ball. I expect them to be big-time players for Lonzo. New York, I think if all else fails with the Chris Pauls and others of this world, New York will be in play for Lonzo Ball. Other teams will be in play for Lonzo Ball. New Orleans, for whatever reason, I don't think they believe that it works. But I want to keep it focused on my young talent, and then try to be opportunistic here or there. Now, if you can get Kyle Lowry at like 3 years, $60 million, I think he'll probably command more. But if you can get him for 3 years, $60 million, by all means, I just wouldn't want to be overpaying veterans just because I feel like I have to make Zion Williamson happy right now. You've got control over Zion Williamson for the foreseeable future. The best interest of maintaining that control when he gets to that third contract is to have a formidable winning team around him that's built for the long term.
No, and you're absolutely right. I mean, we should be clear here, and you have been, and I will be. The clock is not ticking in the way that it was ticking on Anthony Davis, who was already on his second contract with New Orleans when he forced his way out because he'd been there for 7 years and they had not made any sustainable progress. When young guys decide to bolt, it's generally, or it is always, after they've signed their first max tacked onto their rookie deal. Zion's not even at that juncture yet. That comes, what, next year? Or is that this summer?
No, anyway, next summer. He's only in year two. Just finished year two.
Right, exactly. Yeah, after year three. So, and no, as you point out, no one's ever turned it down. He'll sign it. Even if they're a disaster, he'll sign it. They always sign it. They always sign it. And especially if you've got an injury history, which he does, they always sign it. So it's not ticking in that regard. However, everything you do as an organization makes an impression. And it's not that he could force his way out earlier. You just don't want to lose his faith. You don't want to lose his belief that you've got this in the right direction. You don't want to lose ownership's faith either, for that matter. And you can get caught in the crossfire between that if your young franchise star is discontent. And now that their people start talking to ownership and the people above you, like, the point is you've got to keep making clear moves forward, recognize where your mistakes are, pivot. You know, give David Griffin and his front office credit for that much. We can say, well, you blew it maybe with the Stan Van Gundy hire, or at least it didn't work out. You misfired on Steven Adams. Okay, look, they're course correcting as quickly, as swiftly as possible. And, you know, that's not just to keep Zion happy, but it is also to create a winning program and a winning atmosphere, and to give him, you know, again, reason to believe, and to give him meaningful games to play too. You want him to be playing meaningful games down the stretch of next season as a team that's either contending for the play-in or for one of the 1-7 guaranteed playoff spots, or 1-6, I should say. Like, that all matters too. It doesn't have to be major swing for the fences moves. It just needs to be steady upward progress. And, you know, I think a move like this arguably is pushing you in that direction. Now, what do they do with all that cap room? That's to be determined in free agency. But often when teams make that kind of move to start clearing cap room, they've got an idea that, you know, maybe they don't have a specific person who's already wink, wink committed, but they know they're getting somebody, that there's enough guys in play that they feel like they'll come out in good shape.
There's plenty of guys in play. And if I'm one of those free agent point guards, like, today was a great day for me, because at the very least, the Pelicans become leverage in those conversations. So I just want, you know, if I was involved in the day-to-day there, yeah, if I couldn't get my guy at my price, I probably wouldn't hesitate to roll it over into the season and then see if you can get in on the trade market. I mean, we talk all the time about Portland, maybe get in on CJ McCollum and not have to give back bad contracts to the Blazers, be able to give them assets back in return. So I just, you know, maybe they do have their eye on somebody. Maybe they do, wink, wink, have a commitment from somebody. And that'd be great, because they are in need of a quality point guard. But I don't think you need to rush things in Portland. Not yet. Not yet with Zion under his current contractual terms. Let's keep it on the draft for a second, Howard, and look ahead to Thursday, specifically when it comes to the trade market. We have the first deal done, Memphis and New Orleans. As you look across the league right now, the teams to keep an eye on, I'm going to give you mine first and you can jump in after. I'm looking pretty solidly at Golden State. You know, we all know the situation with the Warriors. They are a team built to win right now. Next year, they will presumably have a healthy Steph Curry, a healthy Draymond Green, and a progressively getting healthier Klay Thompson as he comes back from two significant injuries. That's a team that, as it stands, with the growth of James Wiseman and some other pieces there, should be, at the very least, in the middle of the Western Conference playoff field. They want to be higher than that. Now, they've got the number 7 and 14 pick in this draft. They've also got Wiseman, the former number 1 pick, who was a very appealing young prospect. They're going to be players over the next 72 hours or so. And I think the guy that they're going to be calling about the most, or at least checking in on, is going to be Bradley Beal. Because Bradley Beal makes a lot of sense for them, and what they can offer Washington makes a lot of sense for the Wizards. If the Wizards trade Bradley Beal, it's not going to be for someone of comparable value. You're not going to get a 27, 28-year-old all-star back in return. You're looking for draft capital. Golden State's got it. You're looking for a young centerpiece. James Wiseman is it. You're looking for, you know, not too many bad contracts. Andrew Wiggins kind of fits the bill there. There just is a lot of things that make sense about the Wizards and Warriors being trade partners prior to the trade deadline, or to the draft. The issue is, nobody really knows what Bradley Beal wants to do. And it's kind of surprising to me. I mean, the Wizards have been out since what, like middle of May? There's been a couple of months that have passed for Bradley Beal to kind of sit on a decision to be made about his future and decide on. He knows the Wizards situation. He knows now who the head coach is. And I think he also knows, or at least his agents are certainly telling him, and the Wizards probably telling his agents, that the best chance to make a deal that's best for both is before the draft, when your team can recover draft capital and the player can have some kind of voice in where he's going to go. So let's start there with the Warriors, and even you could weigh in on the Wizards as well. I guess my question to you would be, is there any surprise in your mind that we're still here with some uncertainty around the future of Bradley Beal?
I mean, Beal has been consistent. Let's give him this much. Bradley Beal has been consistent over the last couple of years, because I could have made the case, and I think I did, a year ago or 2 years ago, that it was time for Bradley Beal to at least consider his options elsewhere. And that's even before he signed the most recent short-term extension, which kind of bought him and the club some time to see where they would go. And the next big move they made after that was swapping Wall for Westbrook, which I'm not sure truly moves the needle. So I think it's been clear for some time. They've maxed out with Bradley Beal on board. The Beal-Wall thing had gone as far as it was going to go. The Beal-Westbrook thing is not going to go anywhere but down, because Westbrook is on that, you know, he's in that stage of his career where he's slowly but surely starting to trend downward. And you say, oh, he had all those triple-doubles. Yeah, I get it. I know. But it's harder and harder for him to produce it at an efficient level on the scoring part of it. And it's always been kind of a dicey trade-off with Westbrook anyway. We don't need to get into the Westbrook thing. But is there any scenario in which you look at this Wizards team with those two high-priced stars in the backcourt, Rui Hachimura, Denny Avdija, Thomas Bryant getting healthy, whoever else, is there any scenario in which within the next year or two, this is a top four team in the East?
No.
No. So if you're Bradley Beal, squarely in your prime, contract getting down to its last two seasons, and you've got the opportunity to start flexing your leverage and say, you know, let's see where I can go to contend, it makes sense. Now, look, if he decides that he would rather just stick it out, be the good soldier, because I want to win here, as guys say, Lillard has taken that tack in Portland for years. Harden took that tack in Houston for years until he didn't. It's up to those guys to decide when it's time, right? It's not up to you and me. But am I surprised that Bradley Beal hasn't reached that decision? Yeah, of course. Like, it's very clear. The Wizards are not going to get into contention anytime soon, and he's going to start wasting years of his prime. And for their sake, too, flipping him now while he's at his absolute highest value and just enough left on his contract to make him not a walk-away free agent, so teams will still give up something for him, you can get a pretty nice package in return. And so something like the Warriors could offer 7-14. 7-14 and Wiseman, 7-14 and Wiseman and Wiggins to make the salaries work. Whatever iterations you come up with or settle on, yeah, like, it seems too obvious not to happen. But it requires one of two things. Either the Wizards say, screw it, we're not waiting for Bradley Beal to tell us anymore. We're going to just do proactively what's best for our organization long term and reload the cupboard.
Maybe
it takes Bradley Beal actually making it clear to them, which there have been rumblings of, most recently some reporting by Fred Katz at The Athletic. So, like, maybe Beal's getting there. Maybe within the next 48 hours to 72 hours, Beal actually does say, you know what, do it. Pull the trigger. Now's the time.
Let me tell you something, too. I like James Wiseman a lot. I don't like James Wiseman in that Golden State system. I don't think it is built for a big man with his specific skill sets. Right now, he's not a floor spacer. He's not really even much of a mid-range shooter. He is just this really athletic, big guy with some post moves who is still trying to unlock all the talent that's within him. I think you put him in a different system, he could blossom pretty quickly. So I like Wiseman as a centerpiece player in a deal for Bradley Beal. And I love the draft capital. I'm not smart enough to sit here and tell you how deep the draft is right now. And, you know, we've seen plenty of misses between 7 and 14 in the past. But 7 and 14 is a pretty good return in terms of draft capital. Maybe you can squeeze out one more pick down the line 2 years from now from Golden State, however you want to do it. And you take the contract of Andrew Wiggins. I'm not sure you're worse off for it, you know, if you're the Wizards. You give yourself a chance to rebuild this thing around guys that are roughly the same age. Whatever draft picks would come in are going to be the same age as Rui Hachimura, Deni Avdija. Like, they'll be, you know, on that same kind of timeline. So, you know, you kind of noted it. Like, maybe even Washington, I say, you know what, we love Bradley Beal, and he has been a good soldier for us. Especially last season, when things got tough, Bradley Beal wasn't grumbling at all about his future. But maybe we do be proactive here and decide what's in the best interest of our franchise long term. And to me, that's rebooting this thing without Bradley Beal.
I got two other thoughts on this. One is, I think it's obvious from the Warriors side of it. I know people are always trying to you know, say, well, you got to plan for what happens in the post Steph and Clay era.
No,
you don't. You don't. You are all in right now. Steph just had an MVP caliber season. Klay Thompson, if he comes back at anywhere near his old self, plus Draymond.
Draymond got his defensive swagger back,
yeah.
It felt like, this year.
Right. There's the outline of a contender there again, but it's not going to be with a young James Wiseman and the 7th and 14th picks, whoever they become. Young talent does not win at the championship level in this league. It's very, very rare. Wiseman, he barely had a half season, and that was after only having 3 college games. So you cannot afford to hedge bets and say, oh, we got to worry about planning for the future. No, deal with the future when it arrives. In the meantime, you've got a generational talent in Steph and a generational, one of the all-time great scorers in Klay Thompson. You've got a small window, ever shrinking, to try to win another championship, make another finals. You go all in, you trade the youth for veteran talent, and if you can get Bradley Beal, you do it. I will say this, if Beal makes that decision in the next 48 hours, hey guys, I want out. Or if the Wizards proactively decide it's just time, it's going to be more than the Warriors involved here, right? Like,
yep.
Philadelphia's going to jump right in with Ben Simmons plus whatever it takes, because Beal and Embiid together would be incredible. And others will probably jump in too. You know, I could see Atlanta getting into the fray with all that young talent. They can put together multiple pieces to make a run at Beal.
I would be very tempted by a Ben Simmons-centric offer if I was the Wizards, because he is under contract through 2025. That's 4 more seasons you have of a 25-year-old combo guy who's, if he ever discovers the problems with his shot, is going to be like all NBA first team. He's already, like, talent-wise, all NBA second and third team levels. If he ever figures out what's wrong with his shot, you're talking about a superstar in this league. And guys like that don't come around very often. That's the most talented player you can get back in return. He's young enough to do what we talked about there, to fit into that young core.
Well, and it's really hard. You pointed it out right up off the top. You trade Bradley Beal, you know, prime of his career, perennial all-star, and at least in the All-NBA discussion, it's really hard to get back another guy of that caliber. But Ben Simmons is the one guy, unless you want to throw Dame Lillard into this, and he's not officially yet. But Ben Simmons is the one guy who might be gettable. If you're trading and you want another guy who is All-NBA caliber, younger, and that you can build around. And granted, Ben Simmons and Westbrook don't fit together, all that stuff. That's not, you worry about that later. You first get the guy that you can build around for years to come, and then you figure out the details.
I agree. Other teams to look at. I know we did some video on Monday. You mentioned Oklahoma City. I mean, that's a team that's flush with cap space, and it's flush with assets. And from what I hear, Oklahoma City is really determined to try to get up inside that top 3. I don't know if they're going to be able to do it. I think they're targeting Cleveland's pick at number three, but I get the sense the Cavaliers want to keep that pick because there's a perception, right or wrong, that, you know, top three, you're talking about surefire type of guys in that top three type of range. But I think Oklahoma City, up until the last minute, is going to be aggressive trying to move their some of their cash of picks to get inside that top five, top three, I should say.
So that cash of picks, let's lay it out. They have six in this year's draft alone. So they've got, in the first round, number 6, 16, and 18, plus 3 second rounders. And then between now and 2027, they've got 18 firsts and 18 seconds. So when we talk about trying to move up, it's not just, oh, could you move 6, 16, and 18 in this year's draft and get up into the top three? No, you could start piling on first round picks next year, the year after, the year after, the year after, because they've just, they own like 40% of all the first round picks in the entire NBA. So, I mean, they could make a really enticing offer. You could offer like just a boatload of picks to somebody in the top three if you see a guy that you could build around. So it'll be interesting to see if that pans out. If that doesn't pan out, Chris, I still look at it this way. Eight of their top 10 players, this is the Thunder, eight of their top 10 guys in minutes played this season were 22 and under on opening night of last season. That's a really, really young roster. The last thing you need to do is add six more rookies, even if three of them are first rounders, even if one of them is as high as sixth. I just don't know that that is the way to go. First of all, you're not going to have enough roster slots for all these guys. But secondly, you just can't keep building around 22 and younger, you know, top to bottom. They've offloaded Horford. He was one of those guys who was top 10 in minutes. They've replaced him, obviously, with Kemba, who's another older guy. They're going to flip Kemba. There's another possibility, too, by the way. Kemba plus some of those picks for something. It just feels like, you know, I know we all love to joke every year about Sam Presti and his cache of picks, and when's he going to start making moves with it? It doesn't have to be all at once, but it seems like this is the time to start consolidating by moving some of them, because it doesn't make sense to have all of these rookies on the roster in addition to the young group they already has. Plus, you've got Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, budding young star. He's going to start to need good, solid veteran talent around him to start moving that program forward. I got to think that after a year of pretty blatant tanking, this is the pivot point where they start to shift in the other direction, start to build.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, there are other teams I'm watching too. Orlando sitting out there with 5 and 8 in this draft. I would think Orlando would stand pat and try to add pieces because they are in no hurry at this point to rebuild that team. I think the Knicks are going to try to move up or try to move out something. I don't think the Knicks, you know, they want veterans on that team. They're sitting there with 19 and 21. They're looking to add veteran pieces to that roster right now. And they have some cap flexibility when it comes to absorbing a contract, if that's what it comes down to. Toronto's kind of interesting, but, you know, if Lowry leaves, and that seems to be the likelihood at this point, the Raptors are rebuilding. You know, it might not be as dramatic a rebuild as Orlando, but because Pascal Siakam is there and Fred VanVleet is there, but the Raptors are going to be rebuilding. And having the fourth overall pick in the draft with that front office, though, do we even know at this point who is running that front office? I mean, at this point, I have no idea what's happening with Toronto, but I think the Raptors probably want to use that pick as well. So there'll be some intrigue, Howard, on draft night with several teams having multiple picks that could potentially be packaged in to move up or down.
Yeah, and I have heard that Toronto might be looking to move that number four pick and that they might have intrigue in Ben Simmons. That to me suggests that something else has to happen, though. Is that we're going to actually make the pick and then, you know, is Kyle Lowry going to go to Philly in a sign and trade along with the number four for Ben Simmons? I don't know exactly how that works. I just heard some light rumblings of Ben Simmons' interest and that it would somehow involve the number four. But I don't have a lot behind that, just some early rumblings.
Well, Philadelphia is definitely talking to teams about Ben Simmons. And this is not a, you know, we're just fielding calls on him. Like, they're proactive, which is not surprising, given that Daryl Morey is the general manager there. And, like, Daryl, you know, is a trading guy. It's just sort of what he's done throughout his career as an NBA executive. But the thing to remember, and it's been noted other places before, worth noting again here, the Sixers are not looking to take a step back. They want dollar-for-dollar value in return for Ben Simmons, or else they're not going to do the deal.
And they should.
You can always wait until next year. And we say this often on this podcast, but you wait and see what happens with Portland. And maybe you can make a deal there that gets you McCollum or maybe even Damian Lillard. And then you're in a much better situation than if you just rush Ben Simmons out to get something back in return. So Philadelphia will not just be dumping Ben Simmons for, I don't even think they'd do it for Lowry and four. I honestly don't. That improves them probably.
Yeah,
maybe.
It's not enough. It's not enough. And especially because
Lowry's career.
And because they need to contend. And the whole idea is to get, if you're trading Ben Simmons, you got to get somebody else who can help you win a title right now. That's not the number four pick. Again,
no,
youth doesn't win. So yeah. I don't put a lot of stock in that particular rumbling. I'm just saying, for the record, it's there.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about USA Basketball for a minute. USA Basketball on Sunday had its Olympic debut, and they lost, which shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that's watched USA Basketball over the last couple of weeks. They had two losses during the exhibition slate to Nigeria and Australia, and now they have a loss on the Olympic slate, this time to France. Now, USA Basketball will probably get into the medal rounds, the quarterfinals, whatever it's called, because they've got Iran on Wednesday, and they've got Czech Republic on Saturday, and those are very winnable games, even for a team that's had some issues chemistry-wise. But I continue to kind of sound the alarm, Howard, about the state of this team. I just don't feel like they have the chemistry needed to win against upper-level teams. There are a handful of them out there. I mean, we saw France as an upper-level team. We've seen Australia, which put the boot to Nigeria in their Olympic opener. We know Spain is still consistent. I mean, Argentina can beat you on any given night, even though their roster, headlined by 41-year-old Luis Scola, is on the older side. They're just, U.S. team is just beatable, especially when that 3-point shot is not falling for them. So give me your level of concern right now for USA Basketball.
I'd say concern is reasonable. I don't know that, you know, there should be all out panic in the streets. You know,
now, come on, let's panic. Let's all panic together.
I mean, time is of the essence here, right? There's not a lot of time to iron things out, but I think these are things that can be ironed out. Let's stipulate the obvious things, right? This team hasn't had that much time together. There wasn't a lot of carryover from the last version of the Olympic team. They're missing a lot of huge stars, you know, Harden and LeBron and Steph, Kyrie, on and on. They still have the best talent top to bottom of anybody in the Olympic field because that's just the nature of it. The U.S. has more NBA players than anybody else and more NBA stars than anyone else. They had to replace two players. They lost Beal and Kevin Love during training camp. Zach LaVine was in COVID protocols for part of it. Three key players were in the finals. It's Holiday, Middleton, and Booker, so they just arrived. They get it in at, you know, at 1 in the morning, the same day that they're playing that debut. Like, none of that is great, and that's not to say those are the only problems. And they may, you know, those may be problems that plague them throughout because there's not a lot of time to now sort things out. But there's enough talent out there between Kevin Durant and Dame Lillard and the three guys I just mentioned, Booker, Middleton, Holiday, Bam Adebayo, Jeremy Grant, like, you know, Zach LaVine. There's good talent there. They should be able to win games. So then it becomes...
Yeah, but there always is. There's always good talent there.
There's always talent.
Like...
And they've lost before. Yes.
Yeah. How is this team any different than the 2019 team? Like, it's more talented because it's got Durant mostly and Damian Lillard mostly. Yeah. But that was a really talented 2019 team. That was a team that had, you know, Kemba Walker when he was playing at a high level. Jason Tatum was on that team. Like, there were some really good players in 2019.
That team, yeah, but that was like, didn't Tatum got hurt early in that, didn't he?
He did. I forget. I'm blanking right now, but it didn't matter. Like, they had really good NBA players. Like, they were in 2019. They were the most talented. They're always going to be the most talented team,
right? But
like,
this is a better version of that. Even
yes,
so,
it's a better version because of Durant and Lillard primarily. That's why it's the better version. I just, the same problems apply. How USA Basketball became a powerhouse. You peel back the layers of it, and I encourage people to listen to the conversation I have with Colangelo on Friday because we do peel back those layers. But one of the biggest things was that in 2005, Colangelo got a 3-year commitment from guys. He got them to commit to 2006, 2007, then the Olympics in 2008 to play internationally during those three off seasons. And during the 06 and 07 time together, whether it was in practice or in games, they were able to develop chemistry. They were able to learn how to play as a unit, and they didn't come into the Olympics as a team that needed to figure things out. They already figured things out. So in my mind, USA basketball is always going to have the problem we saw in 2019 and the problem we're seeing right now in 2021, that no matter how talented the guys are that you put together, if they don't understand how to play together, they're going to have problems. Because, you know, it's one thing to have versatile defenders, but those versatile defenders need to understand the defense. It's one thing to have a whole bunch of great scorers. Well, you got to basically be deferential in Olympic competition because everybody's a great scorer. Like, until you develop that chemistry, you're not assured of anything, no matter how talented you are. And you're going up against teams that have, like, decades of chemistry. I mean, Pau Gasol is playing for Spain. Pau. Mark is still active in the NBA. Pau's been done for 2 years. Pau is still playing for the CIA. I mentioned Scola, the Australian Olympic team. Like, they've got guys that have been there for multiple cycles. Like, these teams are used to being on the floor together. And This U.S. team, unless they can procure those types of three-year commitments from players again, they're going to consistently have this very problem.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, Chris, is that it's not as if the whole system has broken down. It's just that we're also in a weird period here because of the pandemic and when the NBA schedule, how deep it's gone into the summer, guys who needed to rehab, guys who had other commitments, whatever it is. So we, you know, they lost some key figures along the way. You throw LeBron and Steph Curry onto this team, and maybe we're looking at a completely different picture. You throw Harden and, you know, whoever, pick anybody, Kyrie. Like, it might be very different. But the bottom line is chemistry, as you note. It's about chemistry and lack thereof, and all the talent in the world, if it doesn't cohere, then you are going to lose to less talented teams. And so that's the predicament they find themselves in, but there's still time to kind of figure this out. There's time for the three guys who just came from the finals to acclimate to a new time zone and get settled in. There's time for Popovich and his staff to figure out the best possible combinations and rotation here. You know, I look at, you know, they certainly they had some trouble scoring, but they also had trouble stopping France. And I look at the possibility of an all defensive alignment anchored by Kevin Durant, who's one of the greatest scorers in NBA history or in basketball history. You could put out there together Kevin Durant, Bam Adebayo, Jeremy Grant, who didn't play against France, but who's a great 3-and-D player and a really versatile defender, Chris Middleton, who's a great defender, and Drew Holiday, who's a great defender. Like, you could put out there a suffocating defensive, versatile, lengthy, mobile lineup that could still score a ton, and maybe they just haven't had the chance to kind of, you know, get into that kind of experimenting yet, or, you know, figuring out which five-man unit can be most effective at a given time, because this team just hasn't been together that long. But that is part of the problem, as you note. These other teams, you know, France has been playing together for years, Spain, Australia, Argentina, they got a lot of the same guys coming back.
I'm not sure I want to see Slovenia either. I mean, after Luka went for 48 and 31 minutes. I mean, good God, man.
So what it's
performance.
It is tough. There are warning signs clearly, but they're going to play Iran next. By the time people hear this, maybe they'll have already played them, or that maybe that's on, is that Tuesday or Wednesday?
Wednesday.
So Iran's
Eastern
up
time. It's like, well, Wednesday, it's like Eastern time at 12:40 in the morning. I think it's whatever. So I'll be up late watching that one.
They'll win that one most likely. If they lose that one, then by all means, sound all the
emergency
alarm bells.
Emergency pod, 3 a.m. emergency pod, Howard. 3 a.m. for that one.
I'm not answering.
Yeah, well, I take your point. I think a week is, it's not a lot of time to kind of figure things out. And Booker, Middleton, Holiday just getting off a plane on Sunday morning. I'm sure they've been studying the offense for the last couple of days. Well, maybe not Middleton and Holiday. They've been doing other things like celebrating. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure they've done whatever they can to prepare themselves for this opportunity. But there's only so much you can do. And they're stepping onto the floor with guys that, for the most part, they have never, ever played with. And that's just really difficult to overcome. Even with the talent gap, it's tough to overcome the chemistry that some of these international teams have playing together. All right, I want to finish, Howard, with a quick conversation about next season, specifically when it comes to the NBA's COVID protocols. And this is topical today because over the weekend, the NFL issued a memo outlining its COVID protocols for next season. And Among the bigger takeaways that I had were that while vaccines are not being called mandatory, there will be different rules and privileges for vaccinated players. And if there is an outbreak caused by unvaccinated players, and if that game has to be canceled, players from both sides will bear the financial responsibility. They will not get paid for that week. And the NFL is a game check week. You know, that's a lot of money that most players will be missing out on if they wind up losing a week. And it kind of got the wheels turning a little bit, Howard, on how the NBA is going to handle COVID going next season. Now, they have some time, of course. Their season doesn't start until October. But, you know, with the NFL taking the first step here, what do you think the NBA's response, maybe not response, but what do you think the NBA's next move is going to be?
It's a good question. You know, the difference in their calendars means the NBA doesn't have to sweat this immediately, right? Like, NBA training camps won't open until late September. Preseason games start up early October. The regular season starts, you know, I think, what, third week of October. So there's time. There's time for the NBA to kind of assess where things are going, not only with their own players, but with the pandemic itself. As you and I have seen, there's been wild swings in the course of the, you know, last 16, 17 months since we all have had to get used to this you know, new way of life, for lack of a better phrase. Michelle Roberts recently told Vinny Goodwill at Yahoo Sports that 90% of NBA players are fully vaccinated. That's a pretty strong number. Can they get to 100% or pretty close by training camp? That's still a couple months away. Yeah, that seems reasonable. If they don't, do they need to create some of these same kind of, I don't know if you want to call it inducements or threats or, you know, dire consequences for outbreaks? I mean, like, the NBA did struggle at times this past season, but let's remember two things. One, it was before vaccines were widely available. So they're starting next season in a different world than the one that the NBA began last season. So all those postponements that we saw in January, well, that's all before everybody could get vaccinated. Two, the NFL, you know, a team or a game gets knocked off the calendar, it's really hard to make it up. So saying you're going to lose all salary, you can see it. In the NBA, as we saw with all those postponements in January, the NBA made all of them up. Like, nobody missed. Every single team played 72 games, which was the planned number for the season. So it's easier for the NBA to recoup it if they have to. So I don't know that they would mimic that approach. I also think the NBA generally has a very collaborative approach to these issues with their players' association, whereas the NFL tends to be, I think, a little bit less so. So I don't think we'll see the same thing from the NBA, Chris, but I mean, it definitely bears watching. Like, what will Adam Silver and Michelle Roberts do between now and late September to ensure that they get as close to 100% vaccination among players as possible?
So if it's true that 90% of NBA players are fully vaccinated, then that leaves about 45 to 50 players that are unvaccinated. And I'd like to see the NBA pick up right where the NFL has left off. And that is saying, while we are not going to and maybe can't mandate you being vaccinated, you are going to be a second-class citizen. To play in the NBA, which is a privilege, not a right, it's a privilege. To play in the NBA, you have to be tested twice a day. If you miss a test, you go into COVID protocols, which will cost you between 7 and 10 days, whatever it may be. And during that time, you lose money. You're not paid as a result of it. So while not mandating a vaccine, they are effectively making it really difficult for a player to exist without it. Now, if this was anything but universally recognized as safe, Howard, I might have a problem with that approach. But it is universally recognized as safe. Billions of people have been vaccinated at this point. Billions, with a B. No problems, no issues right now when it comes to that. Nothing other than anecdotal incidents that come up. No medically approved or noted run of things happening because of the vaccine. This is all pseudoscience, is what it is. It's pseudoscience and it's misinformation. And I'm sorry, we tried the carrot with some of these people. Now it's time for the stick. Now it's time to say, here are the rules. You abide by them or you don't play in the NBA. It's simple as that. And I think if you make players who are unvaccinated something like second-class citizen, have them go through all the hoops they went through last year as a part of this, you're going to see the rest of those guys get vaccinated, I think, pretty quickly. I think they're not going to want to go through what they went through last year, not when they see what players that are vaccinated are allowed to do. So I like what the NFL did here, and I would like to see the NBA pick up right where they left off.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the numbers are clear. The vast majority of people getting COVID now, and especially the Delta variant, are people who were not vaccinated. It's all the unvaccinated who are getting sick now and who are getting the worst cases, because if you're vaccinated, you either don't get it or you get a very mild case. So, you know, like all the science is stacked on one side here, and the states with the highest rates of unvaccinated people are the states that have the highest rate of new COVID cases. Like, it's all really, really clear. And it's just so hard. There's so much misinformation out there. There's so much just utter bullshit out there that I understand, like, people, they buy in, or they're, if you're naturally suspicious, it's easy to accept some of the misinformation out there or have it make you hesitant. I get that. I believe the NBA and the Players Association has done everything possible to educate players and staff and personnel across the league about the safety of the vaccine and the necessity of the vaccine. And, you know, look, you're running and wherever they're at now, $8-9 billion business, the NBA, that's what's at stake every time you make a decision about even your individual health. This is like, people say, oh, it's an individual decision. No. This is a decision that affects everybody around you, that affects society. And in the case of being an NBA player, affects your team and affects the bottom line of your franchise and the whole league that, as I say, generates whatever it is, $8-9 billion a year. Like, you have a responsibility. I'm sure that's being hammered home all the time. I'm sure they've done everything possible to educate guys. As I say, it's late July. Maybe when you and I are doing this podcast in mid-September, we'll be talking about how amazing it is that the NBA has gotten to 99% vaccination among its players and how confident the league is going into the season, being able to return to full normalcy because everybody got on board.
Yeah, hopefully that's the case. And again, I do think that if the NBA lays out in the way the NFL laid out what vaccinated players can do and what unvaccinated players can't do, I think you will see that gap close from 90 to 95, maybe even close to 100. And then the NBA will feel comfortable going into next season that it won't be as interrupted as often as it was this year. Howard, good stuff. Stick around on Friday. We will have Jerry Colangelo join the show. And when we come back, my conversation with longtime draft insider Chad Ford. All right, the NBA draft is set for Thursday night. There's already been some movement in the middle part of the draft with Memphis and New Orleans finalizing a deal on Monday. A lot more potentially to come with a handful of teams out there in some interesting situations. Talk about that and much more. I want to welcome in longtime NBA draft insider Chad Ford. You can read his stuff now at NBABigBoard.com. Follow him on Twitter at Chad Ford Insider. He'll be doing live draft night coverage on the Locked On NBA podcast that will be streamed on the Locked On NBA YouTube channel on Thursday. Chad, appreciate your time, man. I guess let me jump right off with what we saw today, and specifically the deal between Memphis and New Orleans. Howard Beck and I talked about this before you came on, so we kind of know what New Orleans is doing with clearing some cap space, trying to make a deal potentially. Kyle Lowry is a name that they're interested in, but as far as going from 17 to 10 for Memphis, I mean, you'll hear some people say, well, it's not a big difference between 17 and 10. Some people say there is a big difference between 17 and 10. Like, in your mind, how much real estate is there between the 17th pick and the 10th pick?
Yeah, they're significant. I probably have a group that's about 7 to 14 in a tier, and then there's a drop off again. So essentially what I would say is Memphis jumped a tier. And the type of prospect they're getting from like a tier four prospect up to a tier three type prospect at 10. And they're sort of at the high end of that tier, right? So they got about the third pick in that in that tier, which is not a bad place to be. I think there's a considerable upgrade for Memphis here, especially given that the guys that they're targeting, they're looking for a big wing, a big scoring wing, also a wing that can be a multi-positional defender. Those guys are in high demand in this draft, and so none of them are going to be sitting there likely at 17. So Franz Wagner, I think, is the guy if he's there at 10. I'm not sure that he'll be there at 10, but he's an analytics darling, and Memphis is one of those front offices that rely heavily on analytics when they're looking at guys. Josh Giddey is a name that I've heard out of Australia as well, one of the best passers in this draft. And then Zaire Williams, a guy who was in my top 10 to start the season, had a terrible season at Stanford, but lots of mitigating circumstances that make you wonder whether he's been underrated, is a 6'10 bouncy, ball handling, sweet shooting, prototypical 3-and-D wing, if he's more like the high school Zaire Williams than the college one. And so, they moved into the range for those guys, which not sure that they would have been at 17.
So as you look at your big board, where does the intrigue begin for you? Where does the uncertainty start?
Starts at 4. I think it's going to be Cade, Jalen Green, Evan Mobley. Maybe Evan Mobley and Jalen Green swap spots, but they're going to be the top 3 picks. And then I think for Toronto, 1, you go Jalen Suggs, who's just sort of an obvious choice there, especially if Kyle Lowry is going to leave. Do you go for Scotty Barnes, who has more upside at 6'8", 7'3", wingspan, who, some people argue with me about this, but he played point guard at Florida State. I think he is a point guard. I think he's just a giant point guard. And certainly if his shot starts falling, you could see him being maybe the best player in this draft, frankly. Or Jonathan Kuminga, who many people thought kind of coming into this draft was going to be about the 4th pick in the draft. He was number 1 in his class before he reclassified. He's one of the youngest players in this draft. And, Masai is not afraid to swing for guys like that. He just isn't. And so there's some really great options there for Toronto. And then 4th, the Raptors are in all sorts of trade discussions right now as well. And so I really think that that's the point in the draft where nobody really knows what's happening. I think that it probably goes some order of Suggs, Scotty Barnes, and Kuminga next. And then from 7 to 14, it's really wide open, starting with the Warriors. Like everybody, every agent's asking me, every rival executive, when they talk to me, the first question they ask is, do we know what the Warriors are doing yet? And I think the answer is the Warriors probably aren't going to know until draft night. I think they'll play this out right till the end to see what they can get for 7-14 James Wiseman. I think right now the market hasn't been particularly hot for them though. And so I'd say just based off their behavior and how many guys they're working out and guys they're bringing back in for second workouts, that right now I think they're under the assumption that they're keeping the picks.
Yeah, I think that you're probably right, especially with Bradley Beal, no certainty there with what's going to happen with his situation. You mentioned the top of the draft and the potential for Jalen Green and Evan Mobley to swap spots. I mean, how difficult a decision do you think that's going to be for Houston sitting there at number 2?
It's the difference between there's so many factors that go into the draft, Chris, as and one of them is, you have owners in the room who are thinking about, how do we market this franchise? How do we get people excited about it again? Jalen Green's the sexiest prospect in this draft. I know everybody's going crazy over Cade Cunningham, but it's going to be Jalen Green that you're going to see on the SportsCenter highlights every night. He is an elite athlete. He's an electric type of player. He's going to be the guy that's going to drop probably a 40 one night during his rookie season. And you go with a guy like that, but Jalen Green is a little bit small for his position. He is not a great defender. He's not a playmaker. He is a scorer, and then everything else is to be determined with him. Or do you take Evan Mobley, who is a true unicorn at 7 feet, who can block shots, rebound, handle the basketball, good passer, can shoot the three, it's got a soft touch inside. I mean, 10 years ago, there's no way Mobley's not the number 1 pick in this draft, as a 7-footer. I just don't think there's any question about it. But because of the priority on wings and because of the sexiness of a player like Jalen Green, maybe he slides to 3. But personally, for me, I don't see a huge gap between Cade Cunningham and Evan Mobley. And I think anybody that wants to make the argument that Mobley will have the better career, I think there's an argument to be made there, as there is for Cade, as there is for Jalen Green, and you know, frankly, maybe even Suggs and Barnes.
Yeah, I think publicly,
a really good draft.
Yeah, publicly, I think people forgot about Jalen Green to a degree because of where he played with the G League Ignite. But you're right, he's the real deal, talent-wise. I know we're in the era, Chad, of positionless basketball, but when I see Evan Mobley and I see Cleveland and I see Jared Allen, I wonder, like, is that going to work? And maybe it's because I have, like, Cleveland PTSD with Colin Sexton and Darius Garland playing together and all the questions we had about that a couple of years ago. But it seems like Jared Allen is a good fit in Cleveland. Seems like they'll want to bring him back on some kind of deal. Mobley, Jared Allen, does that work?
I think it works. I think Cleveland is actually Evan Mobley at two, because one, I think Mobley's right now, especially given how thin his body is much more a four than he is a five. I think Jared Allen's a five in the league. I think Mobley's perimeter game makes it so there's not going to be two centers sort of clogging the middle. And it's not like you're getting Jared Allen on a bunch of post-ups anyway. And I think the other thing is, yeah, I think they'd like to bring Jared Allen back, but Jared Allen has some fans out there in the league as well. And, you know, at what point do you pay him based off of the sort of offers that he might get? Toronto actually being one of those teams that has really liked Jared Allen in the past and tried to acquire him from the Nets. And so, but I will always say this about when you're at this stage, you don't draft for position. Evan Mobley is a significantly better prospect than Jared Allen is at long road. So you don't pass on Evan Mobley because you have Jared Allen. This reminds me back in the days when Portland traded the number three pick in the draft when Chris Paul was sitting on the board and Deron Williams was sitting on the board because they had Sebastian Telfair, and they thought to themselves, you know, hey, we're set at point guard. We really like Sebastian. When it was even clear back then, Chris Paul and Deron Williams were much better prospects as point guards than Sebastian Telfair was. And you've seen teams make that mistake over and over again. I think you can do that later in the draft. I don't think that's a big a deal, but at the top of the draft, I just don't think you do it.
Yeah, I agree. Talent wins out in any conversation about who you're going to take. Couple teams that I'm sort of keep my eye on, I know are very active right now. One is Oklahoma City, which, what are they, six picks in the first two rounds, 6, 16, 18, 34, 36, 55. There's not enough roster spots, Jazz, to put that many guys on your team. I mean, what's your read on how Oklahoma City is approaching this draft on Thursday?
And like 400 future, you know, picks as well. Like somebody's got to, I think Sam's like got to get into like a Assets Anonymous program. Like I think somebody's got to set him down and say, dude, you got enough. You got enough, like you got enough food storage to like last this for like the next 10 years. Let's start using some of these assets to field a basketball team. And it seems like this is the perfect year for them to do that. They fall to sixth in the draft. That's not ideal for Oklahoma City. I mean, obviously they'd like to get to one. I don't think they can get to one. I don't see Detroit, if they trade the pick, trading out of the top three, maybe he can get to three and then maybe to one. I mean, maybe that's a possibility, you know, for Sam. They really do have enough assets to probably put together some sort of godfather deal that gets it all there. But at some point, you've got to see them start cashing in some of these chips and getting players. And it seems like this is the draft to do that, whether it's luring Cleveland into a deal at three or trying to get up a little higher to Houston, who is also in asset collection mode right now. It's also why I think Detroit trading this pick is not out of the realm of possibility, because Troy Weaver, his mentor is Sam Presti. Mm-hmm. And this is how Sam Presti goes about thinking about building a team. You don't get emotional about these players. You think about everything as an asset and you collect assets until you have enough chips to cash it in for an all-star. And so I think that could very well be how Troy Weaver's approaching this draft as well. And you saw Adrian Wojnarowski saying today that they haven't made a decision on Cade Cunningham yet. That doesn't exactly jive with what I'm hearing out of Detroit right now, where I think Cade is the heavy, heavy favorite to be the number one pick. But I do think it speaks to Weaver going to approach this draft and not feel pressure from his fans or other people to make the best deal down the road that he can for Detroit. And so, yeah, I think every team in the league expects Oklahoma City to get involved. But I'm always like, Sam is always on the other end of these trades. He's always the one grabbing the assets, not giving them up. I wonder how hard that is for him. And do they have someone who's going to like hold his hand through that? Because, you know, it's just not something he's been used to for a really long time.
I think he wants to, though, at this point. I mean, you collected all these picks, was it 35 over the next 6 years, whatever it may be, first and second round. And at some point, you've got to flesh out the roster with veterans. I mean, there's only so many draft and stash guys you can take in that second round and keep them over there. On the subject of the number one pick, yeah, I'm with you. Everything I've heard is that Detroit's fairly locked on Cade Cunningham. It would be a surprise at this point if they draft anybody but Cade Cunningham. But are you sold on Cade Cunningham? What's the league-wide perception of Cade? I mean, is he kind of, and if you, and I kind of made this sort of device last week where, you know, if LeBron is the surest thing to a slam dunk and Anthony Bennett's on the other side of the spectrum, like where do you put Cade Cunningham as far as number one picks go?
Well, I think that's two questions. So let me start with this. Am I sold on Cade? Yeah. I think he's got the highest floor of anybody in this draft. I would be shocked if he's not a high level starter to all-star in the NBA. He's just too good. It's the ceiling that I think people are misunderstanding about Cade Cunningham. And, you know, look, I used to work for ESPN, so I understand the ESPN hype machine. I understand that ESPN likes a narrative and they like it. They like it to be who the next superstar is. It's great for marketing. It's great for getting people to tune into games. Like I get it. I felt heavy pressure when I was at ESPN to anoint prospects as the guy. And that's certainly happened with Cade to the point that fans in Detroit are freaking out right now at the thought that Cade Cunningham might not be the number one pick. And I've had people tell me, oh, this is the greatest pick since LeBron James or since Anthony Davis. And I'm like, man, I don't think that's fair to Cade Cunningham. I don't think he's that type of prospect. He doesn't have the elite athleticism of what we think about in the highest tiers of superstars. And there are some warts to his game beyond the athleticism. You know, he had a very high turnover rate. Everybody says, well, his team wasn't very good at Oklahoma State. But I'm like, Evan Mobley's team at USC was arguably worse. And he did more with that team than Cade Cunningham did at Oklahoma State. So you can't totally blame it on that. But so I would say this, he's a really good pick. He's number one on my board. I'm really comfortable with him as the number one pick in the draft. I certainly would applaud Detroit if they take him there, but he is not far and away the best player in this draft, nor is he far and away like the best prospect that we've seen come out of the draft in the last decade. And so I think if you temper your expectations and say, he may be Chris Middleton or he may be Jason Tatum, then I think you're about right. Like, I think that's sort of the way to sort of look at it. But Jason Tatum, as good as he is, and I really like Jason Tatum, you know, he's not burned down the arena if you don't draft him, you know, sort of no brainer like LeBron James. And then I think it's underplayed Mobley and certainly Jalen Green, who maybe if he'd gone to Duke or Kentucky would be generating this sort of buzz. And the irony with Green is every NBA scout will say the G League was tougher. The competition was harder. He had to play against grown men. He was playing NBA sets the entire time. And so he was getting coached to play like an NBA player and not like a college player. Every scout will tell you the G League experience was probably the best thing for him. It just wasn't the best for marketing him and, you know, fighting against some of this buzz that now starts to come. Again, I know Troy Weaver a little bit. Of all the GMs that are out there, I think he's one of them that isn't going to be influenced by this one. Mm-hmm. I think there are some GMs that would be. And I think that if they're sweating your job, if you're wondering, you know, whether I'm going to have a contract in the year, if Kobe Altman was picking number one, I don't think he'd have any choice but to take Cade Cunningham number one. But I think Troy Weaver has it. So I think if he does take Cade, then that was the guy that he thought was the best. But I will say they did like Jalen Green. And before the lottery balls fell the way that they did, that was the guy they were focusing on because they need athleticism. And I also think they need a star in Detroit and felt like Jalen Green could be that guy.
I think Oklahoma City liked Jalen Green too. Sam Presti spent all that time in that G League bubble. I think he was the only GM down there locked in to get a good look at Jalen Green. You mentioned narrative. It's funny, like you bring up Tatum and I just have flashbacks to, you know, the beating Danny Ainge took for not drafting Markelle Fultz that year, because the narrative was that Markelle Fultz was the guy. Hell, I was in the building in Boston when Jaylen Brown's pick was booed by everybody that wanted Chris Dunn in Boston. So narratives, you're right, can spiral out of control sometimes when it comes to these draft picks. Just last thing for you, Chad, on the back end of this draft, which is where every championship team, you see somebody with a guy that see the draft at the back end of the first round, the case of Chris Middleton, second round, Draymond Green, vital to Golden State's success. Give me a couple of guys that you really like that aren't, you know, those lottery picks outside the lottery that you think are, you know, have the potential to be high level guys.
I really like Miles McBride out of West Virginia. I think he's one of the toughest players in this draft, just plays with such energy and enthusiasm, but he also can really stroke the basketball. And it's pretty rare that you're going to find a guard who is elite defensively and an elite 3-point shooter. It's the in-between game that I still think he needs to continue to sort of work on, you know, scoring off the dribble. He seemed a little bit afraid to go and draw fouls for a guard like him, but man, the toughness that's there with him, I just see him, a coach falling in love with him and him being a Kyle Lowry-esque sort of player at the next level. I'm warming up to Sharif Cooper as well. I loved him early on. Then I got a little scared because he's a little guard. But, you know, I've had several GMs tell me I've got to let go. And it's something I hold on to, that little guards can't succeed in the NBA anymore. Chris Paul is a little guard. He was taking shots, you know, over Giannis in the finals and still finding ways to score. Mike Conley is a little guard, led the Jazz to the best record in the NBA last season. Kyle Lowry is going to make $30 million in free agency, and he's not even half the player he once was. And here you have Sharif Cooper, who can get anywhere he wants on the floor, is the most creative passer in this draft, is a little bit shaky as a shooter right now, which is the big question mark about him, but mostly getting knocked because he's little. And when you watch him play, I can't take my eyes off him. He just seems like he's going to be a guy who's going to find a niche, going to get going. And then, you know, we'll all be asking, how did this guy slide in the draft?
What are you hearing about Jared Butler at this point? The Baylor guard just medically cleared by the NBA to be drafted. What are teams saying about him?
Love him. They all love him. And if nothing had happened medically, he's in the mix at Indiana at 13, at Golden State at 14, right at the back end of the lottery, mid first round. He was cleared by the, you know, fit to play committee of the NBA on an undisclosed medical condition. But doctors are coming back. Team doctors now are coming back and looking at all of that. And they're assessing risk right now. And there's some risk there. He's cleared to play, so it's not some sort of morbid risk. That's sort of what the fit to play a committee is sort of looking at. Is this something that could, you know, permanently hurt someone or kill them? But now teams are looking at this as an asset, and, you know, what are the chances that something could occur down the road that maybe make him not be able to play? And I think he's the hardest guy to peg in this draft right now on what that assessment is. And look, doctor to doctor, team doctor to team doctor may differ on how they're going to assess that risk right now. But if he ends up being healthy, he's, to me, going to be one of the steals of the draft, because he can play both positions, really shoots the basketball, hard worker. And he's the rare guy that's a veteran. He played 3 years at Baylor, won a national championship, and he's not even 21 years old yet, which is just remarkable. He's like 1 year older than most of the freshmen that are in this draft. And so if the health stuff turns out, I love him. And I think, you know, so this is going to be the guy that, again, when people are telling the story 10 years from now, they're going to be like, how did Jared, you know, slide there? And then, you know, people are going to dig up and find all this stuff about questions about his health. And I hope that I hope that's what it is, because he's an awesome young man and, you know, deserves the chance to really play in the NBA.
Yeah, no question. Chad, great stuff, man. You can check out Chad's stuff at NBABigBoard.com. Follow him on Twitter at Chad Ford Insider. He will be doing live draft night coverage on the Locked On NBA podcast. That'll be streamed on the Locked On NBA YouTube channel. Jack, good luck with everything on Thursday, man. I appreciate you taking a couple of minutes.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.